This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2016, held at Faith Builders on August 1 through 5.
All right, welcome to incorporating good books into any curriculum. My name is Dina Swanson, and I've taught in some capacity for 33 years, I think. A lot of it was music, where I met my husband. Some of it was homeschooling, and some of it's been in the classroom, both before I was married and then when my children were older. And I've taught with my husband. This will be going on our seventh year that we've been in the same school. And I love good books, and I think they're very important. So that's what we're going to be talking about today. So let's get started. First of all, I think the easiest way, the most effective way, maybe, no, I won't say the most effective way, but the second most effective way to get good books into your curriculum is a read-aloud time. Because that way, no matter what your curriculum is, if you don't have time with everything else, you know, that the school board has chosen or whatever, you've always got that time that you can pick a book, and whenever it is after lunch, we'll talk about some different times when we can do it, but it's that the easiest way is to take 15, 20 minutes, have everybody sit down, and this is our read aloud time. And in several of the sessions over the years, I've heard or teachers just talking, their students love that time. If you're picking the right books and you're doing it the right way, they will love that time. They will look forward to it. I know I've been in the middle of a chapter or something, and when we were team teaching, my husband would come and say, okay, it's time for them to go to recess. And this is like the third through sixth graders, and they would say, Mr. Swanson, can she please finish the chapter? Let her finish reading the chapter before we got to recess, because they were so into it. So I think it's really important, and I think this is one of the easiest ways to do it. Think about it. When you were younger, some of these things might have bothered you, but honestly, now that you're older, somebody said, why don't you just go outside and take a walk or something? Okay, that'd be great. Like, I don't have to cook dinner, I don't have to whatever, I can just go take a walk, it'd be wonderful. Or, why don't you go lie down and take a nap? When you were a child, that was torture, you know. I would love it if somebody would say, I'm going to finish all the laundry for you, Dina, just go down and just go lie down and take a nap. Oh, that would be wonderful. Or, my favorite, what if somebody said, sit down and listen while I read you a story. Come sit on the couch. I'm going to read you a story. I would be overjoyed, thrilled. And I think really when children are younger, that they enjoy that too. If you just say, come on and sit down, I'm going to read you a story. So I'm going to start also by giving you a sample. Let's say that your history lesson was on, or you were studying in history, immigrant migration, when people from Europe were coming over in the 1800s. Okay, and then we're going to do a comparison contrast here. So here's your textbook. From 1820 to 1870, almost 7.5 million newcomers entered the United States. Nearly all of them came from Northern and Western Europe. About a third were Irish, which would have included my husband's ancestors, many of them seeking escape from a famine that struck Ireland in the mid-1840s. Almost a third were German. Most of the Irish had little money, and so they stayed where they arrived on the East Coast. Many Germans had enough money to journey to the Midwest in search of farmland. In the mid-1800s, some states sent out agents to Europe to attract settlers. I want to get to the boat part. Hang on a minute. The flood of immigrants began to alarm many native U.S. citizens. Railroad companies did the same thing. They were trying to attract settlers to come. Better conditions on ships and steep declines in travel time and fares made the voyage across the Atlantic Ocean easier and more affordable in the mid-1800s. News of the discovery of gold reached China.
Chinese immigrants and sojourners streamed across the Pacific Ocean to strike it rich. Okay. If you read that to your students, I'm not sure how much they would get out of that. I'm not sure if they, you had to fill in a blank on your little worksheet next, if they would even catch, you know, any of that. But if you read this, or maybe let's say you did that for your history lesson, but now for read aloud time today, we're going to read Hidden Riches by Romaine Stauffer. And this is, I'm just going to read you a little snippet, but this is a family who was immigrating because of, if you read it, it's really interesting. A lot of it was because of, they had to, the sons were going to have to fight in the army, and the father ends up actually dying, but on his, and this is a true story, by the way, on his deathbed, he says, I want, you know, to the oldest son and the mother or whatever, I want you to go to America. I don't want my sons to stay here and fight in the army. So here they are on the ship. And I don't, yeah, I don't know if you remember what I just read about better conditions on ships and blah, blah, blah. Okay, we're going to live it now. Perils at sea. The Phoenix, that was the big boat they were on that was going to travel across the Atlantic. The Phoenix slowly turned and slipped out of Cowes. That was the city where they were at port. The big moment had arrived at last. It was exciting in a way and yet sobering. The lives of the 688 passengers were now at the mercy of the captain and the weather. Some, who had been persuaded by Newlanders to make the trip, were already homesick, and that the Newlanders would be the people who were promising, you know, come on to America and you'll get land or whatever. But they had no money to return to Germany either. They had been forced to commit themselves to being indentured servants. When and if they ever arrived in Philadelphia, their future did not look very bright. They would have to work for their masters as long as 5 to 7 years to pay off their passage on the ship. Only then would they be able to find their own homes. The little group of Swissers on the Phoenix also had fears and misgivings, but they had something else the others did not all have: faith in God. Though they did not speak of it aloud, they fully realized that they might not all live to reach Philadelphia. Not knowing which of them might die made them sober. Even the small children sensed their parents' tension and were quiet. Yet they knew God was with them. They could trust Him in life or death. He would never fail them. And that's another thing. If you're not going to get that in a history book, usually. There are a few, but you could stop there and point out to your children, you know, if you were on a journey like that, you know, the people that had God, that could pray to God and trust God, would have a much better outlook on things. And then that's setting a good example, you know, for your children, I mean, for your students, you know, that they would hear that. As the weeks wore on, Mother tried to stretch the family's food supply by giving them all smaller portions. Warm food was served only 3 times a week by the ship's cook. So they had to bring their own food for a lot of the meals. Christian was always hungry, and he's the little boy. So now we can relate to this child, or they can really relate to this child. It seemed like years since he had eaten his fill at Mr. and Mrs. Peter's table in Holland. The drinking water in the barrels on the ship had soon become warm and scummy. Now it was turning black and thick. Before drinking, it was necessary to scoop worms off the top of the water. No one drank more than he had to for fear of getting sick. The broiling August sun added to the heat produced by the passengers' closely packed bodies and increased their thirst. Can you feel this? Are you like... Children cried piteously for a drink of fresh water. Older people moaned and wept. Hunger and thirst made them irritable and quarrelsome. Mothers and fathers blamed each other for convincing them to come on this trip. The noise of weeping, complaining, quarreling passengers wore on night and day. There was never a minute of complete silence. Oh God, if I only had a piece of good bread, lamented one whose food supply was gone. Just a drop of fresh water, begged another. If only I were at home again, even if I had to lie in my pig pen, that would be far better than this, wept a homesick traveler. Mother, who had always kept her house neat and tidy, found the uncleanliness of the ship unbearable. There was no extra water for washing. As soon as the last sight of land was gone, many passengers became seasick. Some vomited for days. The ship's crew could do nothing to clean up the mess, and the passengers could not. Rats swarmed everywhere. The stench in the confined area made Christian's head ache terribly. And that was, you know, down below because they couldn't go up. Sometimes. Lice soon appeared, along with dysentery, boils, scurvy, and mouth rot from eating the sharply salted food and drinking the wormy water. More and more people were becoming sick. Every morning and every evening, the group of Swissers gathered to worship God and pray together, asking God to spare their lives. Psalm 107 had become real to them in these weeks since leaving Cowes. They often repeated parts of it by memory. Verse 6 was their favorite. They cried unto the Lord in their trouble, and he delivered them out of their distress. It helped to remember God's faithfulness to the Israelites on their way to Canaan. He could be trusted to bring them, too, safely through hunger, thirst, storms, and illness. Which one would you rather read? The textbook or this? If you ask your students, what did you learn about immigration on a ship? Which one did you learn more from? It's really obvious. Could you feel the thirst and the sickness and the, you know, the smell and the hardships? And then to think, especially in this story, if you had, you know, started from the beginning with your students, that they were doing this, they were making these sacrifices and going through all this suffering because they didn't want their sons to grow up and fight in the army. It's just incredible. So you're learning all about the educational aspect of it. They're learning all about the ships and the water and the food and the rats and the lice or whatever and how hard it was. And they're also learning from a spiritual standpoint two things, that these parents, these people were doing, making huge sacrifices and going through a lot of suffering to do what they felt was right before God because of their convictions. And secondly, how they turned to God. They were praying, they were, you know, reading these psalms and trusting in God to get them through it. Two huge lessons. So, it's amazing difference. And I know which one I would rather do. And to be honest with you, I discovered this because I've read books all my life, but when my oldest son was like 4 years old, I went to a seminar kind of like this. And this was basically the same sort of idea was presented, and I was like, "Well, I know which one I'm going to do," and I've never regretted it. And I've been amazed at how much even the youngest little students can pick up. So, there's our example. All right, this is huge. This is another reason why we should read aloud to our students. A lot of learning does take place when you read books and fill in the blanks, but I think way more happens when we do kind of what we just did, when parents and teachers read books like this out loud to their students, and we talk about it, and we experience it, and they're hearing the language out loud. Huge difference from them just sitting there reading it, kind of maybe hearing it in their own mind, but to hear it out loud. Here we are going to look. This is the age of a child, 1 year, 2 year, three years, 4 years. These are cumulative words spoken to a child in millions. So this is 10 million words, 20 million words, 30 million words, 40 million words, 50 million words. And the point that we're looking at here is that by the time a child is 1 year old, and I don't like to look at this because it's like it's money-based. I would like to look at it more as this is a parent who is working all the time, from any ethnic group or religious background or whatever. This is a parent who is working and the child is off playing trucks by themselves or whatever. This would be a working class parent where they're talking to their child more. They're maybe not so busy. This maybe we would think of as a single parent home or something where the one parent was always working. This would be a home where maybe both parents were there and they would talk to the child, read to the child some. This would be a professional level, and again, I don't like the word professional. This would be a mom who is taking her child on walks. Do you see the cat? Isn't it pretty? Oh, look, here's an acorn. Do you want to hold the acorn? Oh, here's a leaf. okay, now we're back home. After lunch, we're going to sit on the couch and read some books. And then what would you like to do this afternoon? Daddy's going to come home. Do you want to, you know, and not just, oh, go play. They're talking to their child. They're going on walks with their child. This is when they're 1, 2, 3, 4 years old. Giving them little science things to hold. They're conversing with their child even when they're 1, 2, 3 years old. Tons of learning goes on here. So if we look at this, by the time this child is 4 years old, how many of you teach first grade? Okay, you can tell this difference, I know, when they come to your classroom. I'm sure you can. I know I have. This would be a child who was from a single parent home, and that they had to work, whatever the situation was. They would have heard 13 million words spoken out loud to them by the time they were 4. This child would have had 26 million words spoken out loud to them by the time they were 4. That one, whose parents took them on walks and read them books, and grandmother, they went to grandmother's house and baked cookies with grandmother, whatever. 45 million words. So if you do the difference here, there's a 30 million word difference. If you do the math, it's what, 32? Really? Huge difference. Think about the learning that goes on, the comprehension, just all the words they're hearing and computing in their little brains and all that. There's a huge difference when a child goes into school at 6 years old. I call it like their brain is either turned on or turned off. And I think this is a lot of why, because they're not reading. They're not sitting down reading books at this age. They're looking at pictures. They're looking at things outside. They're playing. You know, they're doing all these different things. People are talking to them. Huge, huge, huge difference. And obviously the ones that have more words spoken to them are the ones that do way better in school. They're going to be able to function better. And yes, this can be helped along. But they're going to start out with a steeper hill to climb. So when we're reading these books to our students in class, we're helping to keep that number going up. We're reading books out loud to them, and then just to stop and say, like I did about, I can't remember what it was now, but just to stop and ask a question in the middle of it, you know, would you want to drink that water with worms on it? And, you know, what about that family that ran out of food? What should they have done? You're conversing, you're thinking, you're talking, their brains are turned on, and it will make a difference. You will see it in math. You will see it in science. You will see it in English. They're going to start improving in all these areas because their brains are turned on. They're thinking. They're hearing these things out loud. All right. So in order to do this, I would say make time for reading literature out loud together as a class. Somehow squeeze in 15 or 20 minutes. Your students might beg you for more. I've heard some people say, well, there's no way my schedule and blah, 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 blah. You'd be amazed if you tell them, well, if all of you have your work turned in on time with 85s or higher, whatever your standard is, so they're making good grades. They're not just flopping through their work and making a bad grade. But if you said, all right, if everybody's work is all turned in for the day and everybody has good grades, we'll have, by study hall, whatever, we'll have 30 minutes at the end of the day and we can read more of this book, whatever. You'd be surprised. They're going to be motivated. You're going to end up with more time. And rather than just sitting in my desk, looking out the window, kind of putzing around, number 7 on my math homework, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I'm going to finish this because then we can go back to that story and find out what happened. Does the ship sink or, you know, whatever? What are we getting? And they're motivated and they're going to get it done. So you can make time. You can wiggle things around and you can use that as a motivation as well. So let's make time for it. If you use a literature-based history program, like Threads, for example, which I have used and love, it's wonderful, you've already got it there. In fact, this book is in 3-4 or 4-3. Anybody remember specifically? Anyway, this is one of the books from the 3-4 or 4-3 Threads program. If you're using literature-based history, you're already there. And I want to be careful when I say this because I've made it a habit not to have all these suggestions. In fact, I'm having none this year. But the Because your principal doesn't want you always coming up and saying, hey, I got this new thing. I went to Faith Builders. I have all these ideas. Let's do this and this and this. And they're like, oh, here comes the teacher with a new idea. I've had somebody say that to me. You know, oh, no, here comes the teacher with all these newfangled ideas or whatever. But they do have, I should have brought one, but in the bookstore, I think they probably have it, maybe out here. There is a presentation that Esther Bean and Steve Brubaker did. And there's a little DVD and a little booklet that comes with it. It wouldn't hurt just to say, you know, I learned about this. It's an amazing program. It has Anabaptist history in it. Would you just look at this and maybe consider it? Thank you. You know, leave it at that. You don't want to be annoying or whatever. But if you already are using that, that's great. If not, it doesn't hurt to just ask them to look at it and consider it. The other one that I said is so easy to fit in is a read aloud time. I've been at schools where they did it after lunch. They have lunch, and then they run around for whatever, 15, 20 minutes, and then come inside and sit down for just a minute, and we're going to read for 15 minutes, whatever. Squeeze it in there. Maybe at the end of the day, like I said, if all their homework is done. We had a study hall for several years for the younger elementary at the last 30 minutes or whatever of the day. And the goal was, don't take home any homework. You're here for 7.5 hours. Why do you need to take all this homework home? Get your homework done. And then if they were all finished, it was all turned in, they had good grades, we can read a little bit more. And they enjoyed it. Reading class. I picked this up from a work session. I actually did it here at Faith Builder. I think it was last year. But if you finish the reading book, let's say by the third quarter of the year, you can spend the last quarter reading one of these books. And there are other suggestions. In fact, there are for read alouds that would read alouds for the students to use as reading, depending on what grade you're in. I'm sure some other teachers would have some good examples too, but in fact, Anna there, it was her session that I was in, and she does have a wonderful list. There are 4 different books they can pick from depending on, and she puts them in little groups depending on their reading level. There's different levels of how well they read, but they read them out loud, and I actually did that with my students this year. I would pick a good book, and we would read that and discuss it for our reading time. And we already talked about that study hall. At the end of the day, if everybody's work turned in, we all have good grades, we can read. And it does motivate them. They will really get into these stories, the girls and the boys. I think it's amazing. Any questions about any of that so far? About the schedule, how to fit it in? Okay. And I don't know about y'all, but every year I find I have to kind of tweak my schedule a little bit. Okay, I need more time with math with this group, or they're doing this really quickly, and I can put 10 minutes here, and I wiggle it around. So a couple options there. How? All right, first of all, choose quality books. There are lots of book lists. There's one down. Matthew has one down in the I'm going to give you one in a minute that we're going to talk about. He has one. In fact, my books from last year I got from that list. You can find them all over the place. I prefer to find Anabaptist or Christian ones, obviously. And I get a lot of my books from thrift stores, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but this is one I love to use for an example. If you were flopping through and my family always goes, oh no, mom's in the book section, we're never going to get out of here. But if you look through the books, I look for old books. Like if they have, I guess this is sort of an example, and this is a wonderful book. But if they look really old, especially those really pretty ones, I didn't bring one, but if they're really old, a lot of times they're good books. And the covers, if you saw that, would you not maybe stop and pick it up? I mean, that's just beautiful. It's great art. It's a very interesting book. Wonderful stories about Queen Elizabeth. An absolutely amazing art. I could just sit and stare at the pictures forever. So a lot of them, you can just tell by the cover that this is maybe a really good book. And we've got to be careful. Nonfiction books are easier. It's about dogs or snakes or something like that. Those are easier just to kind of grab off the shelf and leaf through them and make sure there's nothing bad in there. Some of these would take more time to, you know, to read through, but that is one way that I look. I'll look at the spines and I'll look at the covers. So, and get book lists. I have learned more from those and good curriculums that are literature based. I will go through and the ones I don't use, I will go through and pick out the books I think look good. Present them well. We'll talk about that in just a second. And then when you're reading out loud, monitor your students. I've only had one young man one time start to kind of nod off, and so I would, you know, walk over and stand by him or whatever. And one time he kept doing it. He was very good-natured, and I said, okay, you know, I want you to go, like, to the back. And I said, I just want you to stand up. And he laughed, and he did. He had a good attitude about it. But make sure they're paying attention. I've had somebody say, don't they fall asleep or whatever? No, they don't. In fact, they're like this. And ask some questions. Why, you know, what do you think is going to happen? Like, if where I stopped right there is, what do you think is going to happen? Well, I think the ship's going to sink, okay? I think somebody's going to get sick because they drank a worm, you know, whatever they're thinking about. The older ones ask them motivation questions. You know, what was it? Why did they want to do this? And they'll go back to, well, because they were Anabaptist and the boys were going to fight in the war and the parents didn't want that for their children. Good, you know. Ask them questions like that. And then never a wrong answer. Don't shut them down, even if it's just horribly wrong. Like, why did they go? Well, they were in the potato famine. You know what? That was Ireland. And you're right, that did happen. But what about this family? Why were they? You know, never say, no, you're wrong. I had a Sunday school teacher one time that would have this perfect answer in his head. And if we didn't say the right answer, no, no. And it got to where nobody wanted to answer him. So I make it a habit to try to steer it. Like the potato famine. Yeah, oh, you're right. There was a potato famine, and a lot of them came from there. But this family was coming from the other part of Europe. So what was that? You know, that was whatever. So never have a wrong answer. To present them, actually, you know what? I'm going to wait just a minute to talk about that one because we're going to go here. First, talking about presentation, like when you're reading out loud. Voice inflection. Do not read in a monotone. This is really boring. And if I read like this, you're probably going to fall asleep. And part of that, too, I think, is just stopping and saying, would you want to drink water like that? What would you do? You know, what about that family that didn't bring enough food? And that'll help keep them interested and paying attention to the volume. If somebody's yelling, you can, you know, do the yelling. Or if mother whispered to Christian, you can do that a little bit. And your facial expression, I've been surprised. And I do try to look at all my students as I'm reading, you know, to make sure, you know, I put my finger there and then, you know, because you don't want to look up and, oh no, they're all asleep. What did I do? But you want to, you know, look at them and make sure they're with you. In fact, I think good teachers do that. If there's even one student, you know, falling asleep, Jesse, would you like to tell me what you think about that, for instance, if Jesse was in the back falling asleep, which he's not, he's paying attention. So your facial expression, too, you know, it's a good part. I don't know if you noticed when the water had worms in it, I kind of, you know, crinkle up my nose or whatever. Have good facial expression. Keep looking at them. Change the volume.
Change your voice.
So have a little fun with it. Even with my 11th to 12th graders, I've done that. I will, you know, make faces and you know, and they'll start doing it with you. If it's a safe environment, then they'll start going with you and do that. So that's how to actually present when you're reading. Or my suggestions for it. Anyway, and personal reading time, SSR. We would do this. I know some schools, Sharon, y'all do, don't you? Was it 15 minutes a day?
It varies from room to room.
Okay, but like set a timer and say, everybody get out your chapter book that you're reading, that you have given them selections and you've approved or whatever, and you have good books, you know, they're all reading. And we're going to set the timer, and that's all you can do. You can't do your math homework. You can't do whatever. This is our reading time. And for 10 or 15 minutes, they read on their own. That's just another way, if you have the good books in the classroom, that they can pick one that they like. And that's their reading time. That works really well as well, if you can fit that into your schedule. And y'all know the ones that are done with their work early. You know, your students that do that, that's a great thing for them to do, even if you don't have a special set time. You know, I'm done with all my work. Great, get your book out. All right. Now, always be bringing in new books. This was our school library 2 years ago, and I would say about half of those were ours. that I had just picked up at thrift stores, whatever. And again, I put be careful up there. I always look through every single book to make sure there are no bad pictures. I'm not into sharpening words out because I find if you start doing that, you're going to find a lot more and it might not be worth it. And different churches and schools have different standards, but I was always really careful. The only things I would ever have a problem with is if like there were a set of encyclopedias that were already there in the school, or there were already some books or magazines or something that were already there, and I assumed somebody had already edited them, and the students would know. They were really cute, too. They would, like, if they found one of those books that was already there, they would, and they'd get their sticky notes. I'm going to do that again. And they would stick it in there, and then they would, Mrs. Swanson, this has something bad in it. And they, you know, they knew, and I'd, oh, dear, you know, and I'm thinking, well, who didn't edit this, whatever, but it wasn't me. So always look through them. You don't want to put anything, you know, there that's going to make them stumble or whatever. And so I would, almost every 2 weeks, I believe, I would have a stash at home that I would go through, or if one of them would ask about penguins or something, oh, I think I have a penguin book at home. You know, I'd go find that and take it the next day. Or I'd go thrift store shopping or something, and I'd find all these books, and I'd go through them, and I would bring them in. And then this is what I would do. I would say, okay, I've got this stack of books that I got over the weekend. And, oh, by the way, I got you all a bookmark. These aren't for y'all, sorry, they're for my real students. But when we travel, we stop at rest stops just to go to the bathroom or walk around or whatever. And I always look for educational thingies. And sometimes we'll visit them and sometimes we'll read about them and learn about them. But these are great bookmarks. And I'll do this with my students, too. I brought in these bookmarks for you, too. This is a museum. It's got beautiful pictures in it. This is really interesting. The Ireland's Great Hunger Museum at this university, they were sketching some things of the potato famine. Didn't we just read about that in that book? You know, and you can draw the dots between, hey, we did just read about immigrating because of the potato famine. These are the old ships, you know, before steam or whatever. They had these sailboats. This was the homes of Mark Twain and Harriet Beecher Stowe. And I would say, what did Mark Twain write? And if they were older, what form of writing did he write? Satire. And satire is what? And what did Harriet Beecher Stowe write? Does anybody remember? And even my little ones would be like, Uncle Tom's Cabin, what was it about? Slavery. You know, yes, okay. And didn't Abraham Lincoln say, you're the woman that started the Civil War or whatever? Okay. This is New Hampshire's state capital or something. I thought this was cute. I picked this up in New Hampshire on the way to Maine, but it says seal on the beach. And I guess people were finding these seals on the beach and they were calling in, there's a seal on the beach. And the rescue animal people would say, well, that's okay. Seals swim. And Lloyd, you live in California, right? You probably know about this. But they swim and then they go and like rest on the beach and it's okay. And then they go back in the water. And so that's all right. And so this is so funny. Seals belong on the beach. Whales and dolphins do not. So if you see a whale on the beach, there might be a problem. Anyway, so there's some science I just picked up and I'm sharing with my children. Here are Nature's Art Village, and they have, it looks like fossils and art and this big dinosaur. What kind of dinosaur was that? You know, with the little bitty arms? Oh, that was a T-Rex. Yes. And this is beautiful. This is Victorian architecture and like the arts and crafts period art. So you can learn about science and literature and all this, and they're your little bookmarks. So all of y'all, you know, I would tell them, all of y'all pick one and then stick it in your books. Okay, now, these are the books I got you over the weekend. These are really good books, and I think y'all are going to like them. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go through them all, and I usually have enough for everybody. And then if you want one of them, the second time I'll go through, you know, raise your hand, because that way they could pick, I want that one, and I'll see them writing it down. Okay, this is Adam of the Road. This is about a young man whose father was a minstrel in the medieval period, and they travel around to medieval fairs, and they play for kings and at weddings and make up little poems about the current events that were going on that day. This book is a single shard, and you'll notice it won an award. This is about a young boy in Korea who learns how to dig the clay and make the pots and things, and some of them get broken and some of them end up in the palace of the emperor or whatever. Very interesting book. This is one of my favorite books. This is about Hudson Taylor, and my favorite story out of this is they're on the ship, and he was concerned about these people who had never heard about Jesus, and one of the men that he was talking to about Jesus happened to fall overboard. And Hudson Taylor is like, help him, get it. Like he was interested in you know, Christ, and he was thinking if this man had another, you know, chance, he might become a Christian. Let's get him. And the sailors were like, oh, whatever, we don't care. And get the man. And finally Hudson himself jumps in the water. And I won't tell you what happened because you need to read the book. The Kite Fighters is another very interesting story that happened in Korea. And they would actually have these competitions, little boys love this, of flying their kites. And one of them figured out a way to actually purposely cross his kite with the other one. And he did something, a science thing, and they would actually cut the other guy's kite and make it fly off, and then he would win because he still had his kite that was attached. But you have to read the book to find out how he did it. This is a delightful story. This is about some children in a school in France up in the mountains, and they get 10 Jewish children, and they hide them in a cave from the Nazis. And I won't tell you what happened if they found them or not either, because you need to read that book. This is The 100 Dresses. This is a book about some little girls in school who were making fun of a girl who wore the same dress every day, based on a true story. And something happens. And this, for you older students, is the story of a Christian family who made a secret closet in their house and hid 7 Jews in there. And I'm not going to tell you what happened either. Okay. And sometimes it's just going to be, this is a book about snakes, and this is a book about whatever, and I'll present them, and I'll say, okay, who's interested in the story about the menstrual? And the first one whose hand goes up, and by the end of the 3-minute beginning of class before I started my spelling lesson, all the books were in eager hands, and they couldn't wait to finish their math and their English with good grades so that they could start reading their book. So present them, show them the pictures, get them hooked a little bit. And I know they won't always be this exciting. These are some of the better books I brought to show you. But just showing them those things will get them interested in it. Okay, so always be bringing in new books and present them to the class as often as you can, every 2-3 weeks. And then I filled up my bookshelf, and then I had milk crates, and then they were just stacked everywhere. All right. Literature awards. I found this very helpful just to get some extra reading in. What I did was in the summer, I went through my books that I had there in the classroom, and I pulled 20 of my favorite ones out, and I stuck them in a milk crate. Now, one or two, like The 100 Dresses is one of them. They were little chapter books, one or two of them. A lot of them were just little short books, like even the, you know, those Step to Reading, The Titanic and Tut's Mummy and Oh, Hill of Fire. That's my favorite one, where the man is plowing and all of a sudden smoke starts coming up, and the next day it's a little bit bigger, and then a volcano comes up and ends up covering the whole town. That is like a little second grade reading book. My high schoolers like to read that. I was hoping one of them would choose it for a research topic and do a research report on it, but I don't care if they are little children's second grade books like that. If the content is good and it's going to spark their imagination, that's great. We read enough chapter books, and I read enough stuff out loud to them, good literature, that I'm not worried about that. So some of them were like that, and this was for my 3rd through 6th grades. And then a couple of them were chapter books. Some were science books, some were history books, some were just story books. So I made this list, and I got a notebook, kind of like our little Teacher's Week notebooks here, and I wrote the books down, you know, number one, number two, all the way down to 20, the title of the book, and then I put a line beside it, and the children would go back, and I had a little carpet area, and they had to be quiet when their work was done, and they would pull a book out of the thing and read it. So let's say they read The 100 Dresses, and then they would go to their notebook page that had, or they're in the little notebook folder thing. It had their name at the top of it, and they would write the date beside number 18, whatever it was. They didn't have to go in order. And when they finished all 20 books, they got a little certificate that just said Literature Award. And I gave them either a little pack of raisins or sometimes I do the little candy bar things. And somebody was asking me about sugar or Hershey's Kiss or whatever. And then I switched to raisins and peanuts, or they could write down an orange or whatever they wanted. Anyway, something healthier. And they would, and I would just, in the morning before spelling class, I would say, and Rosie finished her literature award and she gets her certificate and her box of raisins. Yay, we'd all be happy for Rosie. And what happened was they loved this. And I thought, oh, come on. They're getting a little piece of paper. And they would, like, take their little literature award to the front of their desk, you know. Okay. I'm sorry. I don't wear a suit coat and I don't put it on there. Okay. And so it was a really big deal. And they were like, you know. And so then they were like, well, can you make me another list? Oh, because you finished the first one. Okay, I guess so. So I had to dig up some more books and find some. We ended up with 100 different books. And they were just going through them like they loved it. It was just a little goal. They could write their little name on there. And they were achieving it, and they were happy, and they were excited. And I think that was the year, too, that we started a bookworm. Our first and second grade teacher had done the year before, and I thought, well, that's kind of neat. We did that when I was in school, and that'd be kind of fun. They got to write their name in the 100 dresses, Dina Swanson, and after lunch, we would stick them up on the wall and see how far it went around. So I told them, all right, if we make it all the way around the room, I'll get some ice cream, and we'll have ice cream cones, whatever. So they did that, and then it went out the hallway, and then it went down the hall. So I put another mark. If you can get it to here, we'll have another ice cream party. And they did that. And then it went out to the upper grades room. And it went almost, what, Jeff, 2/3 around? I mean, by the end of the year, it was incredible. I couldn't believe it. And we counted, and there were 800 and something books that these, how many were in that room? 12? 12 children had read 800 and something. I couldn't believe it. I was just shocked. And all I did was make this little list of 20 books in the summer that I thought to get it started. So when they would do a new one, I would just put it in the notebook, list number two or list number three. And they loved it. Just another little thing to keep them reading on their own when they had finished their work. You know, I try to have my students either work on the art project for the week, because we would do an art project on Friday, and then they have to have it completed by the next Friday. So they could work on it all through the week. They could do more. They could make bigger art projects or smaller projects, whatever. They could read, and then something like Bananagrams or something educational, though. They weren't allowed to sit in their desk and drool or stare out the window. They had to be reading or doing something educational. All right. Give books and bookmarks as gifts. We already talked about the bookmark thing. I also like to give them happy birthday, you know, or if we have an honor roll party, we'll put, you know, whatever, Bible Times honor roll party, spring 2016, and put that on there for bookmarks and laminate them, or get that, even you can do it with tape. For my older ones, I started with a dictionary, and then the next year I gave them a thesaurus, and then I got, and I've given my younger ones, they were really into birds. One year they had a bird memory game, and they learned all the names of the birds and stuff, so I gave them a bird identification guide one year, and a bat book. I had one group of elementary students really into bats. I started doing this series, and I do notice they have all of these over in the bookstore. You can order these in groups of five, and then I would figure out, okay, he's a boy, and so he probably likes this Jim Elliot book, and she's a girl, and she's interested in medical stuff, and so maybe she would like the whatever it was. And this little girl loves to babysit. I'll give her the Amy Carmichael book, you know, and I would try to go through and pick them, and then I would write in there. I think one of these has it. It doesn't, but to Joseph from Mrs. Swanson, 2016, or whatever, and then they would have these little books, and every year I would give them one. I did this for a couple of years, and they would come up to me, you know, in the summer, oh, I love that book you gave me, thank you so much, or I finished it, or I'm so inspired. One of the girls was gave her an Amy Carmichael book, and she was going to go to India. She might still, I hope she does, and be a missionary. I mean, you never know, but anyway. Give books and bookmarks as gifts to encourage them to read throughout the summer or whatever, or for Christmas or something. This is another way that you can get good books into the curriculum. Let's say they have to do a book report. Somebody asked me this the other day, and they said the curriculum already picks the book, or they have to pick a biography or something. And for that age group, I thought, well, maybe they're not really interested in a biography. I know I loved them when I was older, like 7th, 8th grade, but not maybe in 5th grade or something. So let's say you're studying, I just did Apologia's Ocean Creatures of the Fifth Day or whatever. So let's say in science, you're studying ocean creatures. So you could say, okay, what are some things we've learned about in science? Oh, the starfish, because they lose an arm. Great, write that up there. What else? Oh, those gross hagworm things that have slime on them. Great, write that up there. What are those things, Jeff, that have the horrible mouth? And with the chewy, or do you know? Lamprey? They're in that family. Yeah, they're in the lamprey family. That'd be a good one. I'd write that up there on the list. Yeah. But no, there's some, it's horrible. It has these horrible teeth and it chews. It's in the jawless fishes. It's in that family. Anyway, write that up there and all the different things. And so some of them might say, oh, I want to do that. Can I do a report on that one? And they've already read about it in their science book and it's going to be helping them with their what they're doing in science. And they're really interested in it. So they really want to do their book report on that, not on some man that I've never heard of that I'm supposed to read this biography. And I'd probably make another history list for the students that might like history more. And let's say maybe they did learn about the Age of Invention, and they do want to read about Thomas Alva Edison. Well, great, we'll write him up there. Or we were studying immigration. And I thought, what about the potato famine? That's good. Write the potato famine up there. What else? What are some of the things? What was like on the ship? Great, write that up there. What about a ship that sank? Okay, write that up there. And then tell them, you pick one of these things we've been learning in science or history. And I want you to write it in your journal and maybe try to pick two or three that you're interested in or just pick the one you like and I'll read it and I'll tell you what I think about it. They're going to be way more interested in reading books about that. And then I would go to my bookshelf and I would pull every book I could find on starfish or whatever, you know, whatever it is, or find them, oh, here's a book about immigration that you might want to read or the Mayflower or whatever. Find books on it. Then they're excited about it, and they're going to be digging in it. Now, I remember the first time this hit me, I think I was in 7th grade, and our history teacher, I can remember the room to this day, it was down in the basement of the school, and it had just had these little bitty windows up high. It was kind of a, I don't know, after lunch kind of class. And he said, okay, you have to do a report. I'm like, oh, no, you have to. By the way, we shouldn't ever say that. We should say, you get to do a report. You get to pick something that you love learning about. You get to write about it, you know, learn more about it. And I started thinking, and I thought, oh, that lost colony of Roanoke that we learned about, that was so interesting, you know, where they all that was left was the carving on the tree, and they disappeared. But some of the Native Americans in the area had blue eyes, so they think maybe the ones who survived had gone to live with the Indians or something. It was this great mystery, and anyway, so I picked that, and I was so excited about it, and I researched it, and that's when it hit me that I need to just pick things, topics, that I'm interested in. And if you just ask them a lot of times, they'll, well, I don't know, but if you start talking about what did you learn in science, what did you learn in history, and you write those ideas up on the board, and you can see them, that, oh, I like that one. Well, maybe that, you know, they're getting excited about it. So that is another really good way to do that is to let them pick whatever they want for a book report, as long as they don't pick, you know, a tiny little thin book. But if it's a subject that interests them, let them do a book report on that. That's great. And books on tape during art class. We've done several projects where we'll introduce it, we'll get them started, and then they will sit and, were any of you in my husband's art class? Okay, like the torn paper art, or, oh, we did quilling one time where you cut the little strips of paper and they wrap it around a toothpick and they glue it. So basically they're sitting there working quietly or sketching or whatever it was. And, I haven't, to be honest with you, I haven't done books on tape, although I do have one that I would like to do for that. Fern Ebersole did a wonderful reading of The Secret Church when the Anabaptists were hiding in the woods and all that. But what I've done is Don Quixote. We were studying something, I don't remember. And so while they were diligently working on their little art project, I was walking around the room, peeking at their art projects, reading Don Quixote, where you know he thinks he's a little crazy, but he thinks the windmill. Anybody know this one? He thinks the windmill is what? wasn't it a giant knight coming to get him or something? So he gets on his old, you know, million-year-old horse and his old rusty armor, and he gets his spear, and he's going to go attack the windmill, and here he is, you know, riding to attack the giant windmill, you know. So they're learning about windmills and all these different knighthood, whatever. And one time, this was with some older ones, but I love The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, Coleridge. And so I was reading this poetry, you know, walking around, and they probably thought I was strange, but that's okay. They were hearing good literature while they were doing their art. And if you're busy grading papers or something, you could get, a good quality book on tape and read it to them. And I do want to stress that one more time. Just to be reading isn't enough, because there is a lot of junk out there. If you can pick books that are either good missionary stories or good quality literature, or even better, like I said, if you were studying the immigration, you can get books that go along directly with what you're studying in history, good quality books. I know some teachers just pick a fun book that their students will like, and that's okay. I've seen a lot of bad examples of behavior in that, you know, and that's not the kind of book I would want to read, number one, because it's not adding to our history and our science curriculum. Number two, it's just not setting a good example for the students. Like this was, they were praying on the ship, they were reading the Psalms, they were doing what they were thought was right because they were convicted of it, and they were turning to God, you know, to help them. That's way better of an example, and there are so many good books that do have good examples, that do have good content, that I don't think we need to turn to some of these silly little frivolous books, although some of them are fun and interesting, but I would just be careful maybe to not weight it too heavily on too many of those. Okay. I wanted to go through, I'll give you the book list in a minute and we'll talk about it, but I just wanted to go ahead and show you a few more of these first. If you are studying Anabaptist history, and this one did not get on the list because it's an older book and I couldn't find it. I'm still unpacking my books. I moved over a year ago. This is embarrassing. And my husband built me this huge, beautiful bookshelf, and I'm slowly unpacking it because my history books have to go here, my science books have to go here. And so anyway, but I couldn't remember the title for this one, and I just found it actually in the bookstore. But it's the story of the Waldensians. This is like pre-Anabaptist Minnow Simons, whatever. But they wanted to follow God, and they end up going over the mountains. Like, they have to flee their homes, they're being persecuted. Wonderful story for Anabaptist history if you're teaching older grades, like before you get to all the normal Minnow Simon stuff. This is a really neat missionary story, Torches of Joy. If I'm studying Indians, a lot of times, like the Native American Indians, a lot of times I will go to a missionary story where they're going into a tribal culture because they still have spears and caves and huts, and you're still kind of learning that those concepts and that way of living, that culture, but we're getting a missionary slant on it. Across Five Aprils, if you're studying the Civil War, this is a really good book. His family ends up fighting on both sides, and it's not from a non-resistant perspective, but I think whenever I read a book like this, I end up being more convinced that non-resistance is right, just because, you know, his leg was amputated, and they were all, you know, they wanted to go home, they were miserable, and they thought, oh, this is great, we're going to go right off to war. And in one part of the book, the brother deserts, and he's hiding in the woods, and he, you know, because he hates the army. It's horrible. He wants to get out of there. They're starving and cold and, you know, whatever. I was teaching American history one year, and the book and the curriculum I didn't like, because about the 8th, 9th, 10th grade level, some books start weaving some romance in, and I didn't really, all this has a tiny bit in it too, I have to admit. But anyway, I wasn't crazy about that book, and I thought one of my pastors had this, and I asked him about it, so I read it, and I thought this would be really good to use. Mennonite boys who end up running off, and again, I don't want to tell you what happens, but it's a really, really good story, and they end up being convicted of their family's beliefs. Really, really good. If you are studying the civil rights era. No, this would be post-Civil War, actually, but it's good to study for that, too. African-American families, sharecropping, and how they're treated. I read part of this in one of my sessions. The white children had the brand new school with the big sports field and the nice bleachers to sit on for the sports stuff and the beautiful fence. And the black children right next door, African-American children, had four old houses up on brick stilts, and they had 80 of them in each room with one stove and one teacher. And the white children had a bus they would go to school on, and while the African-American students walked 1 hour to school, the bus would drive by and splash mud on them and everything. Really good book to get your students to have empathy for other people just because they're different. It's in the list I'm going to give you, but it's Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry. Wonderful book. Really, really good. And there's actually a really good character study in there, too. There are some children, both African-American and white, who make good decisions, and there's some children on both sides that make bad decisions. And I love to stop and say, why did he do that? What made him do that? And we talk about that. Wonderful ways to teach character as well. And then The Land I Lost is by a man who grew up in Vietnam. And he plows with his water buffalo, and the war comes through, and it just different, amazingly interesting book about that. So, and then these are always wonderful. George Mueller is one of my favorites to inspire faith. You know how they run out of food? Y'all know this story, right? They run out of food. They have no food. And so all the children file into the orphanage, and they stand in front of their empty plates, and he prays and thanks God for their meal. And then there's a knock at the door, and the baker brings a bunch of bread, and the milk truck broke down, and they have milk, like, right there. It's just incredibly good faith-building story. So there are a few in this series I'm not crazy about, but these are really good. Okay. All right, we are out of time, so this is the book list, and again, there are a lot of them I feel like I left off because I wanted this to be pretty clean and have nothing in them. There are a few that have a little cross by them. Those are ones that might have a little bit of cultural weird stuff in it, and There will be extras that end up at the back. The ones with a little, like, cross by them, like the one, it's a wonderful story about the potato famine. But there are these little, they believed in these little, I don't know what they were, elves or something, you know, that. And so I would read that to older students and explain, you know, why did they believe that? Well, that was wives' tales that had been handed down, and they didn't know any better, and they didn't have a good church or whatever. Do we have any extras that can be passed over? Okay, can you pass them that way? Thank you. Hiding Place, obviously, they're killing Jews in a concentration camp. It doesn't get really gory, but I would not read that to younger ones. And if you're not sure where to start, if you just look at the ones with an asterisk by them, those are my all-time favorite. Just a really good place to start for just any read-aloud time that have good content, good cultural information, and good character information. So, we are out of time. If you have any questions, please come find me and talk to me, or I'll be in here for a little while. And also, one more thing, everybody, don't read and look up at me real quick. God bless you for being teachers. There are so many things we could do with our time and make more money and do whatever. I think that this is one of the most important jobs that anybody could have, because we're teaching young people and hopefully teaching them to know and love God. And I think it is so important. I think it's wonderfully fun. I love teaching, but I think it is so important and should be so valued. So God bless you. I hope you have a good school year. Bye.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.